Then we move on to the next talk. Yeah. Now we have sort of the theoretical pendant to this first introduction. Let me introduce Professor Benecke. He started his studies in Konstanz and did his PhD after studies at different places than at Munich. He went on to Aachen, and now he's back at the TU Munich, and he will tell us about the theoretical aspects of the flavor physics that we basically just heard.
Yes, good morning. It's an honor and a pleasure to speak at this symposium on nature at the energy frontier. And my feeling is that there are at least as many talks on the energy frontier as on low energy type of physics. And that just highlights the fact how important is the study of quantum fluctuations in present day high energy physics. And flavor physics is certainly a prime example for this. In fact, it sets a precedent by indicating the mass of the charm quark and the top quark through meson mixing. Now, today, flavor physics is a rather phenomenology-driven field, and it's a huge field, so I have to make some selections, partially biased, but because it's phenomenology-driven, it's certainly not accidental that there's some overlap in topics with what Ulrich discussed in the previous talk, but I hope I can give you a complementary and more theoretical perspective. Anyway, so in the cherished standard model, which is based on the gauge symmetry and specifying field content and their gauge charges, flavor physics is related fundamentally to the Higgs boson. And so you may wonder what the discovery of the Higgs boson means for flavor physics. So these are the three terms in the renormalizable part of the Lagrangian you can write down, and you know very well that there's a lot of freedom with field redefinitions, and that allows you, after electroweak symmetry breaking, to move the flavor-changing effects from the Higgs boson to the gauge bosons. So they're only charged currents, and the only physical degree of freedom is a neutral Higgs boson. And so, in the standard model, there are no flavor-changing processes, would be neutral current processes associated with the Higgs boson. And so there seems to be no very direct implication of the fact that we now know the mass of the Higgs boson on flavor physics. Nevertheless, it's worthwhile to think a bit more from the fundamental level what it means that we now know that this field which appears here is not simply a constant background that generates the mass matrix, but has its own quanta. So we are used to think of the standard model as consisting of matter particles and gauge particles which create forces. But now we have a new force. It's on the one hand determined by the gauge symmetries, because it's the gauge symmetries that we imposed that specify the precise structure of these terms. But the force itself is not a gauge force. In fact, it's very unlike a gauge force because it couples to an internal degree of freedom, the flavor index, which is not related to a local symmetry at all. It's also very unlike gauge forces because it couples to the mass of particles. So it's more like non-relativistic gravity than like gauge forces. And it's actually much stronger than gravity, but very short-ranged. It's also amusing to speculate a bit further because it's very plausible that there should be an extra term here which couples the Higgs boson to the lepton doublet and a neutrino singlet, a particle which has no gauge charges at all. And nevertheless, this force couples to this thing which has no charges in the sense that we are used to them. And it's amusing to think about the fact that it's precisely this force which is responsible for our existence, because if this right-handed neutrino is in the right mass range and has the right couplings, then it generates a lepton asymmetry, which then further on triggers the baryogenesis. So there are a lot of interesting implications of these terms, fundamentally, but if we talk more specifically about flavor physics as we do it today, there are no direct implications within the standard model. There's another term that is related to flavor, which comes at the dimension 5 level, presumably related to neutrino masses, but there are two very different communities which stand behind these terms, which usually don't talk much to each other unless they are grand unified. And so, from this perspective, having flavor violation in the standard model, the very fact that one has it, also the very fact that one has CP violation, is very natural. And in the standard model, especially for CP violation, it's also very predictive. So, before, let's say 1999, where CP violation was only observed in KL mixing, you could speculate whether there was something fundamental or mysterious about CP violation. But from today's perspective, it looks very natural indeed. The phase, we now know, is large, so CP is not an approximate symmetry, certainly also not an accidental symmetry, and we simply have to get accustomed to the fact that while realizing the homogeneous Lorentz group is apparently fundamental, realizing the discrete components of the Lorentz group is not, and that's just so. Nevertheless, there are a number of problems that one associates with flavors, and you could classify these problems in two. Just within the context of what we wrote down here, you should ask what are the values of the many parameters associated with the flavor sector, and why are the parameters as they are? You know, they have these hierarchical structures, both in the diagonal elements and the off-diagonals. So why are these numbers what they are? So the origin of flavor hierarchies, this I would call the first flavor problem. It's a very hard problem, and there's very little new theoretical ideas on this, and perhaps the most recent one that has some implications on this would be a warped flavor in warped extra dimensions, and maybe I have time to come back to that at the very end of this talk. There's a totally different kind of flavor problem, and that's the question whether that's really all there is as concerns flavor and CP violation. And in particular, if it's not, why didn't we see it already? And so this touches the issues of hierarchies and naturalness. And I think it's been mentioned by Ricardo before that you write down the standard model as an effective theory, then the parameter connected to the Higgs mass is the only dimensionful parameter in the standard model, and it's naturally associated with the cutoff scale of the standard model. At the same time, at the dimension 6 level, there's a lot of new quark flavor violation in the guise of 4 quark operators, and they should be suppressed by 1 over the cutoff scale. So, since we now know that there is a light Higgs boson, this cutoff scale, if you follow the naturalness assumption, should not be so far away. And so having discovered a light Higgs boson makes the flavor problem more severe because it naively makes this term more important. Now, from what we know about flavor violation, if the couplings of these dimension 6 terms are totally arbitrary, have no hierarchical suppressions like in the standard model, then this scale must be larger than thousands of TV. Scales very far above the TV scale. And not accessible to LHC in its generic form. And very generally, it's very difficult to construct natural models of flavor. And so you may conclude from this what you want. Maybe it's a problem, but maybe the argument is simply wrong because nature doesn't really care about naturalness. I sometimes think, thank God, the great minds of the 60s and 70s didn't worry about naturalness. Otherwise, we didn't have a standard model at all. So, if we think about flavor in the LHC era, then LHCb is a fantastic experiment that offers new opportunities in B sub S meson physics, electroweak penguins, other things. At the same time, we have now high energy collisions which produce new particles, the Higgs, and also the top in large numbers. And so there are new players in the field. You can ask about flavor changing transitions concerning Higgs and flavor physics, and in particular, you can ask how the two could somehow connect together. And so to the very specific structure of the Standard Model, you really have to, I mean, this is really physics beyond the Standard Model, where the two connect to each other, and you have to derive the constraints within specific models. For instance, within specific models, even the direct production of a particle, even if the production has nothing to do with flavor, obviously tells you something about the implications of these particles in flavor physics, and vice versa. But this happens within the context of a specific model. So now I'd like to turn to some more specific topics, and one cannot start a review on flavor physics without recapitulating a bit the progress that has been made over the past, well, nearly 20 years. And this is most vividly shown in showing the evolution of the so-called unitarity triangle fit. Unitarity triangle fits meaningfully start only after the discovery of the top quark at the Tevatron, because before you inferred the mass of the top quark from BB bar mixing. So you couldn't use BB bar mixing as a constraint on the unitarity triangle. And so after the top discovery, this was the unitarity triangle fit, a very broad range. Then in the early 2000s, the B factories turned on and they yielded the famous measurement of the BB bar, B sub D bar mixing phase, which is this wedge here, which cuts into these other constraints and selects a much smaller region. But what's perhaps even more impressive is the progress in precision flavor physics that's been made over the decade of B-factory physics that turned this region into this very narrow thing. Now, if you look at this, everything looks perfectly consistent. But a global fit like this hides a lot of things. And given the number of observables that one has, it's also no longer an adequate representation of the richness of all the information we have from various flavor-changing processes. And so in this sense, this could be misleading, because a lot of non-standard things can be hidden elsewhere or can be hidden in inconsistencies here. And I think one thing that bothers me most is actually not connected to new physics at all. It's in a sense an embarrassment that after more than a decade of precision studies at B factories, we still don't know the strength of B to U transitions with adequate accuracy. Worse, there are two different measurements from exclusive decays B to pi plus lepton pair, and the same transition, but simply inclusive over all final states. There are different experimental techniques, totally different theoretical methods that apply here, lattice QCD mainly here. Here, concepts, inclusive concepts like heavy quark expansion, resummations due to the kinematic constraints. And this is the result, a difference of maybe more than 30%. And in most weights, this adds in the square. So this, I think, is a major thing that needs to be resolved. It also has implications for the consistency of the entire fit, because if you now look at the consistency of VUB with the measurement of sine 2 beta, which is shown here, this is sort of the distribution in sine 2 beta. This is the experimental direct measurement. These are the fits of sine 2 beta, depending on whether you use the inclusive or the exclusive VUB measurement as input. And so the exclusive one is sort of consistent, but the inclusive one is not. So you could think, then I pick the exclusive one, which is actually my personal pick anyway. But if you do that, then you get into constraints elsewhere, because if you look here, if you lower this, then you get into constraints with epsilon k. So these are the games that one can play. I personally don't think it's a very significant thing here, but what is significant is that one should resolve this issue once and forever. And I guess this will come from improved lattice QCD in the end. Also, no one in the field could really tell you what's actually wrong with the theory or the experiment that goes in here. So turning to PistaBass mixing. This is really the Eldorado for LACB. You've seen the beautiful plot in Ulrich's talk where you can resolve the PistaBass oscillations. And all this comes from a very simple box diagram. There's an awful lot of physics which is hidden in this box diagram here. And first you might think this is boring because we know B sub D, so B sub S, you just change the D quark here from B sub D to an S quark here, so what? But it happens that the strength of this transition here, S to top, is 5 times stronger than the one B top to D, and this makes a lot of difference in the phenomenology. The lifetimes of all B hadrons are approximately equal because they don't care about the spectator quark. But mixing is related to the spectator quark through the box diagram. And as you know, for BB bar mixing, the real part is dominated by the top contribution, and so it's 25 times larger for the BS meson, which results in large oscillations. At the same time, the phase of this object is very small, which results in a very small mixing phase. Now, another curious thing in B sub S mesons is that the imaginary part, the absorptive part of this diagram, is related to an imaginary part in the mass matrix, and it gives rise to a lifetime difference between the two eigenstates. Because the CKM element VCS is of order 1, one gets a much larger contribution to the lifetime difference. This is simply due to the fact that B sub S and B bar sub S have a large set of common final states through the B to CC bar S transition, which is relatively strong. And you can, even though these are sort of inclusive on-shell calculations, the decay into common final states, one can compute this in QCD, and it turns out to be suppressed by 3 powers of the B quark mass, because in the box diagram you have to bring these close together within distance 1 over MB, but because this is a one-loop diagram, while the decay squared is a two-loop diagram, you gain some phase-based suppression, and this leads to a lifetime difference which, relative to the lifetime itself, is of order 10 to 15%. And it can be computed quite accurately, including power corrections and radiative corrections. There is a phase which Ulrich already discussed, but there's another phase, which is the relative phase within the mixing matrix itself. I mean, this is the phase of the real part together with the phase for the B to CC bar S transition. This phase here, the mixing phase itself, comes from the up type and the charm type contribution to the box diagram. Both are small, but they are distinct. And this one requires QCD computations, while this is a pure parameter of the CKM matrix. So this was already shown by Ulrich, so I will make it short here. The thing I want to highlight here, that this is a very nice interplay of QCD physics in flavor physics and something that's pure quantum interference, the mixing phase itself. And you see both of these things in a single plot. This is QCD calculations, and you see how nicely they agree with the measurements. And this is the maze. This is the measurement of the fundamental B sub S mixing phase. Now, the implication of the fact that this is in agreement with the standard model, it sort of closes the last large loophole in the mixing sector. There are no large deviations in the B sub S mixing phase. On the other hand, it's not yet a very precise measurement. On the other hand, if you think about generic flavor physics, because the strength of the D to T top VTD transition is much smaller than VTS, generic new physics should be much more important in B sub D mixing than in B sub S mixing. And we know that in B sub D mixing there's no large contribution from new physics, while in the minimal flavor violation paradigm you don't expect any sizable contribution to this phase. So expecting a deviation here is really an expectation of some a model with a rather ungeneric flavor structure. B sub S to mu plus mu minus, another highlight for LHC B physics, was measured last year. So this is once again a pure flavor changing neutral current process, which is generated by these loops. The remarkable thing in the standard model is, again, there are no scalar currents of any appreciable strength, flavor-changing scalar currents. So in the standard model, the decay width is dominated by this term, which is an axial vector transition. And this has this strong helicity suppression here. So this, in principle, makes it possible that this decay branching fraction is very different from expectations, and it's sensitive to scalar couplings. There is a slight twist here again, which is related to the lifetime difference, which leads to the realization that what you calculate is not really what experiments measure. You can correct for this, but for reasons of time, I'll skip it. And you have already seen the result that the LHC measurement is right in the ballpark of the standard model with, again, I stress this, an appreciable error. So this is a model killer to an extent. This plot from David Straub shows you various supersymmetric theories in the plane of B sub S to mu plus mu minus, which is now measured here, and B sub D to mu plus mu minus, where there are only upper limits presently. And so from this, you should get the impression how constraining this decay is, ruling out all kinds of supersymmetric models. This figure shows the constraint in a supersymmetric model between tangent beta and the pseudoscalar Higgs boson mass. And I show this plot because it nicely illustrates how flavor physics constrained in a given model, in this case, supersymmetry and direct collider physics constraints work together here in constraining the parameter space. So these lines here are various supersymmetric models, and everything above this line is excluded by Bs to mu plus mu minus. The gray area here is excluded by Higgs decay to tau tau, because if tangent beta is sizable, then there should be a large enhancement of the Higgs to tau tau branching fraction. And so you can see how the two work together. Now, in a sense, again, I think these plots are somewhat misleading. It would be wrong to conclude that now you measured B sub S to mu plus mu minus with 50%. It's only 50%. And so now it's not interesting anymore. And yesterday someone had this quote from Sam Ting, there is no such thing as disappointment. I like that because disappointment is usually a consequence of exaggerated expectations. And so in this particular case, I mean, you focus on a very specific class of models, namely supersymmetry with large tangent beta, where scalar currents can be greatly enhanced. But if you're maybe a bit more realistic, you go back to this formula here. And so what this measurement really tells you is that you cannot have an appreciable contribution of scalar currents to observables that have no helicity suppression. But scalar currents are usually generated by Higgs bosons, and we know that in most of the theories that are admissible, Higgs bosons somehow couple proportional to mass, so maybe you shouldn't really expect this. On the other hand, in generic models, if you have a pseudoscalar Higgs bosons, like you have in generic supersymmetry, you can have an interference of the standard model contribution with a pseudoscalar contribution, in which case you can well get suppressions of B sub S mu plus mu minus. So large enhancements are not a generic prediction, but an expectation that might have been exaggerated. So now we talked about simple processes like the mixing phase, which is really free from any theoretical uncertainty because it's pure quantum interference of amplitudes. We talked about B sub S to mu plus mu minus and the lifetime differences. These are, from the point of QCD, still relatively simple quantities because they involve only one hadron in the initial state and at most one hadron in the final state. And as soon, so here you can use methods like the heavy quark expansion, lattice QCD can do this, or you need no theory at all. As soon as you go beyond this line here, and you have processes with two hadrons in the final state, it gets really complicated for QCD. And so here you see some red processes that we partially discussed. And what I want to say is all this area of non-leptonics, all the variety of QCD penguin transitions is here, and there are really many, many new LHCb results here, which I have no time to discuss, but they are very worthwhile. And so we often talk about interplay between theory and experiment, theory, experiment, and high PT experiments and flavor experiments, and we mean phenomenology. But if you think about the interplay of theoretical methods, this is an area where there is an interplay in theoretical methods between collider physics and flavor physics, because to address these things, you have to rely crucially on concepts like collinear factorization, like parton distributions get replaced by light cone distributions. And so you need theoretical concepts that are really, really close. So the same philosophy, like in collider physics, isolate infrared singularity factorization, all the technology applies here in a different guise. And the only thing which is kind of unfortunate is that you can't change the mass of the B quark mass like you can change the energy of your collider. And so I have no time to talk about this in detail, because I want to talk about the electroweak penguin decay, where actually these methods are quite important. Ulrich already mentioned this decay, and I think it's really a prime example how the interplay of sophisticated experimental concepts, ideas, and theoretical methods makes this into a gold mine for LHC and flavor physics. And so the idea is that in the standard model, these flavor-changing neutral current processes, once you integrate out the heavy particles, generate these operators. It's called an electroweak penguin process, because contrary to the well-known process like B2S gamma, the final state with two leptons can also be generated by Z bosons or by box diagrams like those. So not necessarily through a photon. And so again, due to the V minus A nature of the weak interactions, the standard model generates these operators with a particular chirality. Only the minus chirality is generated in the standard model. Beyond, there could be other chiralities, and there could be a whole set of tensor, scalar, and pseudoscalar operators as well. And what makes this process so rich is that other than B2S gamma, where you don't really have much except for the total branching fraction and maybe the CP asymmetry, here you have a multi-body final states. You can measure angles. So there is a Q-squared distribution, the invariant mass of the lepton pair, and then there are, depending on what you allow, up to 12 angular coefficients plus the CP conjugate, and all of them are functions of Q squared. So there's an awful lot of information that's hidden in a complete angular analysis. And so what I'd like to do in the next 5 minutes or so is to illustrate a bit how the theoretical framework for this decay is such that it makes it really a laboratory for precise studies of the chiral and the tensor structure of a new flavor-changing currents. Now, first, you might think that because there are only two hadrons here, one in the initial, one in the final state, and a lepton pair, you might think this is simple from the QCD point of view, because all you need is a form factor for the B2K star or B2K transition. But that's not so, because not everything is short distance. There are four fermion operators with charm and up quarks, but the charm quarks are the relevant here. So you have a short distance transition here, which is this blob, and then you can close the charm quark loop, and that's not short distance. And then you can couple a photon to the charm loop, and the photon decays into a lepton pair. And so this is kind of a contamination. It's also related to QCD penguin operators, but it's not really a source of new physics, because we have a lot of knowledge on QCD penguin operators from non-leptonic decays. So we don't really expect a lot of new physics in this term. So the matrix element for this transition is a term which consists of a form factor with calculable coefficients that depend on all the interesting Wilson coefficients. But then there's an extra term here which corresponds to this diagram, which is non-local. Probably not new physics sensitive, but it's important at low Q squared because it has the photon pole here. Worse, it has charmonium resonances when you tune the Q squared of the lepton pair to the mass of a charmonium. So when you look at the spectrum for this decay, then it looks like this. There are charmonium resonances, and at small q squared, not shown here, it would rise due to the photon pole. And depending on the Q-squared region, one has to apply different theoretical methods. So at small Q-squared, the hadron, the kaon in the final state is very energetic. So here you have to use these methods from collider physics and apply collinear factorization to this process. And then you get a formula like this up to corrections of order 1 over mb. On the other hand, in the large Q-squared region, this kaon is very slow. So there is little momentum transfer to the final kaon. So here you can use the methods of heavy quark effective theory. And it's very remarkable that it basically turns out that despite the complications of this charm loop, you can compute this in terms of a form factor term up to corrections which are practically negligible. Quite surprising. And then in between there are the charmonium resonances, and they are this really very hard to make theoretical predictions, so it's customary to just cut these regions away and focus on the so-called low Q-squared and large Q-squared region. So the reason why this is theoretically also so clean is a very deep fact of QCD. First, that it conserves parity. And then when you have a very energetic quark, again, this is reminiscent of collider physics, then it costs you a power of lambda QCD over energy to flip the helicity of a heavy particle, in this case, a heavy quark. And so this means that when you consider the form factors of a B to K star transition, due to the chirality of the weak current and this parity and helicity conservation, you can produce the kaon only in one of the possible helicity states. And that reduces greatly the number of independent form factors, in fact, only two. And so in the end, you can write the complete angular distribution, and this is not the complete one, this is only a two-dimensional one, in terms of just two unknown form factors. And then you can form ratios. And one of the traditional observables here is to focus on the forward-backward asymmetry in the angle between the positively charged lepton and the B meson in the dilepton rest frame, which is this term. And then you can see that this term has a zero if this coefficient happens to be zero. And this coefficient can be computed with these methods. And let's not worry about this. And so then you can make predictions, both at leading order, then you compute the QCD correction. It shifts this zero by a GV squared by 25%. And this was predicted long ago, and this is now the LHCb measurement, and it's very nicely consistent with this. In fact, it's very nice to see that the sensitivity of the experimental result is already as large as the next leading order QCD correction here. And you can turn this around, and let's suppose you measured this zero, then you can directly determine the coefficient function of an electroweak flavor-changing neutral current as a function of the measured position. And so this is the result. And so this illustrates that here, despite the fact it's a hadronic decay, despite the fact that you have these problems with charm resonances, that there is very clean physics that can be done here. And it can be done much better, as was pointed out by Ulrich and collaborators, and then many people jumped on this and pursued it further, because the fact that you have only two form factors means that you can take the angular coefficients, you arrange them in a nice way, so such that they are mostly proportional to only one of those. And then you have a set of angular coefficients which is proportional to only one of those form factor things. You take ratios, they drop out entirely, up to power corrections and up to alpha strong corrections. And so there are many observables of this kind, and this is an area which LHCb only just started studying, and it really has a great potential because it can really resolve the chiralities and the precise nature of electroweak penguins. So at this point I take an intermediate summary on what I would call traditional flavor physics, mostly related to B mesons. I didn't talk about D mesons and K mesons. And so I'd like to emphasize this point. It's the beginning of a new era of flavor physics at LHCb. Super B factory, one super B factory is coming in a few years. If you look at the things that we discussed and the ones that we see, then one can say, those of you who work in the field remember the past 10 years, all these discussions about anomalies that come and go away. So in a sense, flavor physics looks more standard model-like than ever in the past 15 years. but it's also worth pointing out, and I think I made this point with the exaggerated expectations. I think we have to get used to the fact that the standard model is a very good approximation to physics at the electroweak scale, probably up to the TV scale. So there's no large effects at the electroweak scales. And so that means that 20% corrections are certainly possible experimentally, theoretically. And if you think that flavor, I mean, there's the sensitivity of very high scales is based on the assumption that there are no small couplings, no flavor structure. As soon as you think the new theory is weakly coupled and has some flavor structure, standard model-like, then the sensitivity is also only the TV scale. And so in the future, it's precision that matters. Means a good theory, that's a real challenge for theorists, and it means clean observables, like we saw in the case of the electroweak penguins. So let me skip this and turn to sort of new dimensions of flavor physics. Because top quark physics was pioneered by the Tevatron, but only now top quarks are produced in appreciable numbers so that one can think about doing detailed top quark structures. And then there is the Higgs boson, and it decays. So it's very worthwhile asking whether there is flavor-changing physics related to top quarks and Higgs quarks, Higgs bosons. And of course, there is flavor-changing physics connected with top quarks. We saw it in BB bar mixing. It's crucial. It's amazing how important the top quark is for traditional flavor physics. But it's charged current top quark physics. And it's related to VTS and VTD, which happen to be very much smaller than one. If you ask about interplay with collider physics, then VTB is too large. So you'd like to do flavor physics at colliders, but it's sort of this disparity between the CKM elements that makes this very hard in the standard model, because basically collider top quark phenomenology is dominated by VTB, and everything else in the standard model is very hard to see. And this is illustrated by the size of flavor-changing neutral currents. If you compare T to charm gamma with B to S gamma, then these factors are more or less the same. But then the Jim suppression tells you that the amplitude is proportional to the largest mass of the quarks that goes around in the loop, and that gives you a huge suppression for top quark flavor-changing neutral currents. So there's little interplay in the standard model for top quarks. If you go to the Higgs, I already mentioned it, there are no flavor-changing neutral currents or no flavor-changing couplings at all at tree level in the standard model. They are loop-suppressed and CKM suppressed to an extent that this leads to very small flavor-changing branching fractions in the standard model, not observable at any present collider experiments. So this is clearly beyond the standard model physics, and it's open to all kinds of speculations. And so I'm not talking about this one, I'd like to talk a little bit about Higgs, because it was mentioned in various occasions at this symposium that it's worthwhile to think about exotic things like flavor-changing Higgs decays, not just mu mu, tau tau. What about tau mu, for instance? And so this is now an example where the interplay between low energy and high energy direct constraints comes to the forefront, because you should ask, what can we say model independently or within a specific model about flavor-changing Higgs couplings? But let me first stress the point that as soon as you extend the standard model by dimension 6 operators, it is rather natural to have flavor-changing couplings of the Higgs boson. If you take the Buchmüller-Wieler Lagrangian and you write down all the possible couplings of two fermions and one Higgs boson after electroweak symmetry breaking, and these are the relevant operators, and I write it down for leptons for simplicity. So this is the normal Yukawa interaction of the leptons, and then there's just one operator which is simply a copy of the Yukawa interaction, and then you add phi dagger phi. There are other operators which can be shown not to matter here. Now, this can have another, in quotes, Yukawa coupling, but there's no necessary relation between this matrix and this matrix. So once electroweak symmetry is broken, this operator gives rise to a correction to the mass matrix where you put all the Higgses to the VEF, but it also gives a correction to the Higgs fermion coupling. In this case, you put two of the phis into a VEF and you keep the third one. So here you have three possibilities, and that's a factor of three. So the convection is different for the mass matrix and the Yukawa matrix. And so this breaks the mass coupling relation, and the misalignment between these two matrices also generates flavor-changing transitions of the Higgs boson. So this is very generic, and it happens actually in many, many models beyond the standard model. And so you can parameterize again for the example of leptons, these couplings in this way. And after going through this, you can see that here's the standard contribution, which is proportional to mass. And then there's an extra term, which is suppressed by the cutoff of the standard model, but then it involves a matrix which does not necessarily have the same hierarchies as the leading Yukawa matrix. So now you might ask the question, is it possible that there is an appreciable flavor-changing branching fraction of Higgs to leptons or quarks at LHC, which maybe has not been measured, so it will be part of the invisible width of the Higgs boson? And so this is the question. I don't work on this myself, but this is a question that was pursued by these people here. And so again, there are quite a few low energy constraints from the impact of flavor-changing Higgs currents on meson mixing in particular. So for the quarks, it's mainly meson mixing that constrains this. And then, of course, the EDMs almost always kill all the possible phases. And for the leptons, it's mainly radiative penguins that matter here. The, let's say, mu to e gamma, tau to mu gamma, the trilepton final states, mu e conversion, EDMs, anomalous magnetic moments. And it's not obvious, but if you look into those, you see that it's practically always the radiative penguins that matter here, also for things like the trilepton decays. Now, there are also high energy constraints. In the case of top quarks, this comes from single top production, same sign top production, not very significantly from LEP, Z couplings, so Higgs, and top decay to Higgs plus jet. And so you ask yourself what branching fractions are allowed here. So you make a fit to these coupling constants, and then you see that really meson oscillations in the quark sector are very constraining. 10 to the minus 7, 8, etc. Kaon are always the strongest constraints because the mixing is most suppressed in the standard model. And it's only the top sector where there are not so stringent constraints because there are no low energy constraints on top quark flavor changing neutral currents. On the other hand, if you go to the lepton sector, then there are strong constraints from EDM, strong constraints for the mu to E transition because of the very strong bounds on mu to E gamma, for instance, mu E to mu E conversion. But then you see that the tau sector is much less constrained. So the tau to mu and tau to E transition. So from this you conclude that it's very hard, practically impossible anyway, to see any flavor changing Higgs decays in the quark sector. But maybe there is something available for leptons. And so not for mu to e gamma. You can see here this would be the constraint if the branching fraction was saturated by mu to e gamma, Higgs to mu e, while mu to e gamma constrains these couplings to a ridiculously small number. On the other hand, in the tau sector, the situation is close. So tau to mu gamma gives you a limit to 10 to the minus 2, and this would be the limit if a 10% branching fraction H to tau mu were hidden at LHC. And so the conclusion is this is still possible. Now, there are some problems with this kind of analysis because it assumes that somehow by new physics you generate these flavor-changing Higgs couplings and nothing else. That's dangerous because we saw that for leptons, almost all the constraints are dominated by the electric dipole transitions. But presumably new physics will generate these electric dipole transitions directly by some high-scale physics. So it's not clear whether such a model-independent analysis is really reflecting what you can get in any realistic model. And I'd like to illustrate this point. I have only, including conclusions, three more transparencies, illustrate this point very briefly with the warped extra dimension models. I mentioned those in the beginning because they are really legitimate models of flavor and solutions, potential solutions to the gauge hierarchy problem. So I presume you're familiar with this scenario that the world is five-dimensional and we live on one of the brains and the space in between is strongly curved. And so in this scenario, even the standard model fields can propagate in the bulk. And so there's been a lot of interest in these models because it's been realized that if you allow, let's say, the fermions to propagate in the bulk, then because the space is strongly curved, even small differences in the masses, the five-dimensional masses of these fermions, curve the zero modes very strongly. In other words, you add some potential energy in the fifth dimension, and if you're looking at the lowest, the massless excitation, then it requires the profile to be very strongly dependent on the mass of the particles, such that particles with small mass are more strongly peaked here, the others here. And so there's a lot of phenomenology that's been done over the past few years on tree-level flavor changing processes in this model, and it leads to very strong constraints. But only recently people really attacked the problem of computing penguin-like transitions. Penguin transitions are loop-induced, so you have to understand how to do full five-dimensional loop calculations in these models, and this was recently addressed with various degrees of rigor by several groups. And so I'm not going into the details of these calculations, but I want to illustrate what it might mean for the analysis of flavor-changing Higgs couplings. So in this case, we would be interested in a dipole operator, tau to mu, because we are interested in h to tau mu. And we saw that the constraint on h to tau mu would mainly come from tau to mu gamma and related processes. So in these models, you can generate, this is for quarks, so take this to be a tau, take this to be a mu. In this model, you can generate a tree-level flavor-changing Higgs transition by a tree diagram like this, where here in between, you go to the KK excitations of the leptons. And these are very heavy, so you contract them, you put two Higgses to a VEF, and that generates a local coupling here, which is hidden here in this square. And so then you can estimate this thing, which was done by Azatov et al. And this tells you that this generates precisely this flavor-changing coupling that we discussed before, and it will be of this order of magnitude. At the same time, there is a similar diagram, but in this case, what propagates in the loop are also the Kaluza-Klein excitations of the fermions themselves. So in this case, the entire penguin loop is short distance, you contract it to a point. And so you can again estimate the size of this coefficient, and it turns out to be much larger. It doesn't have the mass suppression factor that you get from the additional Higgs coupling here on this side. So the point I want to make is that you really have to do a correlated analysis if you assume local physics of the flavor-changing Higgs coupling that come from the dimension 6 operator with phi dagger phi, together with the dipole operators and also probably the four lepton operators that are generated directly by high-scale physics. And in this particular case, the Randall-Sundrum model, this constraint is much stronger. So in order to prevent, to avoid the constraint from tau to mu gamma, you would have to make the scale, the KK scale, so large that this direct effect is negligible. Yeah. So the constraint goes away. So this is a very rich field for studies, the study of flavor-changing Higgs and top quark physics. I only scratched the surface here, and so I think I need to conclude with a few very general statements from the flavor physics perspective. From the broad perspective, very broad perspective, flavor physics indeed looks more standard model-like than ever. So let's phrase it positively. It supports the idea that the standard model could be valid to the Planck scale, as does collider physics. What a dramatic statement. And so, is this disappointing? Well, I personally think there's a lot of fascinating physics. Fascinating physics, I mean, maybe we're emphasizing too much the issue of fundamental physics. I mean, there are really fascinating processes in flavor physics, if you think about what it means to probe these systems with quantum interference and what it means to probe quantum fluctuations to the level of detail that we can do. And I think that's very fascinating in itself. But coming back to fundamental physics and new physics, keep in mind that in this flavor physics thing, 20% effects are still possible. And it's very possible that TV scale physics makes only 20% effects. And so it's really precision that matters for flavor physics, for LHC in the future, for LHCb. And so depending on what one sees at high energy, you could say that flavor physics constraints are maybe more important than ever. Certainly, we'd love to see more guidance from LHC physics. And finally, an area for the future, a rich area, I think, is the top at Higgs, two new particles that sort of add extra dimensions to flavor.
Thank you very much for this highly interesting contribution. I'm sure there are questions. Please.
Martin, perhaps I missed the first 5-10 minutes. You didn't make any comment about the alleged CP violation in charred mesons, discovered and then undiscovered. The saga, I don't think, my impression is that it's not completely finished, because there are still several measurements and they're spread. Do you have any opinion on that?
Well, it's more a question to the experimental community, because you know there are two measurements of the CP asymmetry difference, slightly different methods. And so theorists started losing a bit of interest until it is.
Well, let's say that the negative measurement, they screwed it up. Okay, well, okay, I mean, I can say it, I'm a theorist, I don't care. So there was also a theoretical question, because there was a big debate, this thing cannot be computed, theoretical corrections are not under control. At least on that, do you have any opinion?
Yes, so, I mean, I didn't work on it myself, but my colleagues, I refrained from using factorization methods for charm physics, because it's kind of borderline, but it was done, and you get estimates, and they are kind of inconclusive, whether it could be a standard model QCD effect or not. I think it would be very stretched. My own risky statement, but I would say the standard model cannot produce more than 0.2-0.3%. Yeah. So I always tended to believe that this is an experimental or a new physics problem.
Thank you. Next question, Thomas.
In your table on flavor effects in the Higgs and top sector, you were quoting the Higgs production in top quark decays. Now, how is the constraint to be read? Is this the branching fraction is below 0.34? Is this the measurement, or is this the best you can get from the current knowledge of, say, the CKM matrix?
No, this is a measurement.
Okay.
So I don't really know what reference 50 is. Mm. I mean, there are constraints on branching fractions of the top that are not bottom W. Mm. Are not particularly strong, but you also see that the constraint is not particularly strong.
Yeah. So this will by no means come up to constrain, say, the CKM matrix at any level close to what we have from BDKs. No. Okay. Thanks.
Further questions?
Well, maybe just to make a comment on VUB. I agree that this is really one of the somehow challenges of flavor physics, is to make a better and a conclusive measurement of VUB. And I think it's one of the areas where the B-factory Superbell will potentially be able to do this incredibly well in the long run by using measurements where they fully reconstruct one B and then they simply look inclusively on the other side, because I think it should be acknowledged that both...
Talking about the inclusive
for the inclusive measurement, yes. Because the issue is somehow at the moment that the inclusive measurements has some serious experimental challenges. in terms of that it's a very, very difficult measurement to make with a very high background level. On the other hand, the exclusive measurement, as you say, has some problems related to the exact understanding of the form factors coming in and so on. So I think in somehow in the long range, I think we will get there through these B-beam measurements, as they're called, from a Super B factory.
So what's your guess? You said your guess is the remove towards the inclusive because you think there's an experimental problem with the exclusive measurement?
I can't say. You know, I have not worked on the inclusive measurement myself, but you know, when you look at it, you can see that there's many, many background contributions you need to understand very well. And I certainly do not think really that in the current way the inclusive measurement is done, I think it's hard to see that it can be done better. So you need to move to a new way of doing it, which then requires two orders of magnitude in luminosity.
Thanks. More questions? Comments? No? Then let's thank the speaker again.